Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Coming up on Eating Matters, I'll be speaking with Heritage's own Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food, about the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act that's back in the news. Stay tuned. Hi, and welcome to the first episode of the spring-summer season of Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and I'm so glad to be back broadcasting live from Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking about recent activity on the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act that, almost a year later, is still not finalized. But before we get into the topic at hand, I want to introduce a new segment for the show, where we bring you yesterday's news today and briefly discuss some of the biggest food policy stories from the past week. First up, we have soda taxes, which took center stage this past week. Oakland City Council members proposed a soda tax for the November ballot. The proposed tax would charge 1 cent per fluid ounce, estimated to generate $6 to $12 million annually for the city. The revenue would fund education programs aimed at improving children's health. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, the debate over the Philadelphia proposed soda tax took national spotlight when Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders stood divided. Clinton expressed strong support for Mayor Kenney's proposed tax, a 3 cent per ounce tax that would raise an estimated $400 million for the city over 5 years. Generated revenue would fund pre-kindergarten education. Sanders opposes the tax because he does not support a, quote, regressive tax, which indirectly would increase taxes on low-income and middle-class Americans. This is not the city's first attempt to pass legislation of this kind, as Mayor Kenney's predecessor tried and failed to institute a similar tax. Soda's policy, as you know, if you've been a listener, is a big issue, and we dedicated an entire episode to it last season, which you should check out. It's called Soda Policy, What's on Tap, if you want to learn more. Moving on, in a throwback to Upton Sinclair, new rules released this week from the Labor Department and supported by the Obama administration will expand whistleblower protections for food industry employees. According to the new rules, food workers who report food safety violations or wrongdoings cannot be fired or disciplined for disclosing information. And there's nothing ordinary about it. Taco Bell has committed to eliminating antibiotics from its chicken by early 2017. The announcement follows similar pledges from fast food companies, including McDonald's and Subway. And finally, a new study came out on Monday in the Journal of Obesity, which found that although obesity prevalence rates have plateaued in recent years, there's no indication of a national decline. Ashley Skinner, a researcher at the Duke Clinical Research Institute and the study's lead author, said she found a consistent increase in obesity across all age children from 1999 through 2014. She also emphasized a continued increase in the rate of severe or morbid obesity amongst teens, which rose from 6 to 10% within the given time frame. Womp, womp. Okay, now I want to turn my attention to the issue at hand, which we're going to be talking about today, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act, or CNR for short. This legislation authorizes all of the federal school meal and child nutrition programs, which provide funding to ensure that low-income children have access to healthy and nutritious foods. It's also important to note that every 5 years, Congress reviews the laws governing these programs through the reauthorization process. And speaking of this process, CNR has been back in the news over the past few weeks with proposals being put forward by the House that some are finding controversial. Joining me to further explain where this bill is in the legislative process and what's at stake for millions of children who rely on programs funded by this legislation is fellow Heritage Radio Network host Laura Stanley. Laura is the host of Inside School Food, the leading news source about the progressive work happening on USDA school meal programs. For 20 years, her work as a journalist and project director has supported pioneers in the restaurant and industrial food supply chain, working towards a healthier, more sustainable, just, and humane system. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jenna.
How does it feel to be on the other side?
Kind of weird.
I can imagine. Okay, well, we're so glad to have you on the show today. I could think of nobody better to help us kind of dig into some of these issues. So before we kind of get into some of the more nuanced policy questions, I want to set the stage for our listeners. So can you give us a brief overview of the types of programs authorized by this legislation and why they're important?
Well, as you said, it's authorized every 5 years, but it is permanently. It's actually the federal child nutrition programs, which don't just include school food. I know we're going to be talking mainly about school food today, but they also include other child and family nutrition programs such as WIC, SNAP, summer food service program, things like that. And what Congress does every 5 years is review the laws governing these programs, and that's what we mean by reauthorization. And as you know, your listeners probably know, the last reauthorization was for school food, really historic in scale, because there were these really ambitious changes in nutrition policy and meal pattern requirements that were, you know, not just aimed at reducing obesity, as they always had been, but there's like a new emphasis on getting kids familiar with fresh food, particularly fresh fruits and vegetables.
Right, which was a real step change from what had come before it.
Yeah.
What is the purpose behind reauthorization? Like, why does this have to happen?
Well, okay, that's a bigger question. I'm not sure I can entirely answer that, but certainly, you know, because I'm not a legislative expert person, but, you know, it's really about just making sure they're on track. So, you know, the policies change as our understanding of nutrition changes, as our food culture changes, as our politics change. So every 5 years, you know, ever since this, you know, we've had a USDA school lunch and breakfast programs, you know, there have been years, you know, times when it was tweaked and times when it was really changed.
And the real change happened in 2010.
As I said, it was historic. It was a big year.
Right. Okay, so for our discussion today, we're going to primarily focus on the school feeding programs that have been particularly controversial in this reauthorization process. So those are the National School Meals Program and the Fresh Fruits and Vegetable Program. Can you kind of help outline some of the key players involved in the reauthorization process and implementation of these programs?
Sure. It gets complicated, but I'll give you the quick version, and then you can ask me questions if I haven't told you enough. But the way it works is there's two committees from each House of Congress. So there's a Senate Agriculture Committee, and in the House there's a committee called the House Education and the Workforce. And it's very complicated. They separately draft their own child nutrition bills, and it's an arduous process that involves more than a year of, you know, behind closed doors meetings plus public hearings with a host of constituents, and those would include child nutrition advocates, people in the food industry, people in the food service industry. You know, I can tell you more about those shortly, but I want to go back to the process.
So,
so what they need to do after they've consulted with all those, they need to draft their reauthorization bill, and then the Senate goes first, and they were, the whole business was supposed to be done by September 30th of last year. It's usually delayed, so the Senate's Senate committee's bill went to the House and was approved in early January. The House bill only hasn't even gone on for markup yet, and by markup I mean it gets released to the full House for discussion and amending and so forth. It's not even there yet, so what we have now is just a draft that's not yet been marked up. That there was an actual leak of that bill that Politico made earlier this month, and I think the leaking of the bill was what really hastened the official release of the bill. That's my theory.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah.
Some spy craft.
Who knows?
Or whatever.
Okay. Oh, and I should add, you know, I didn't finish explaining. Eventually, so, you know, this big creaky process involves, you know, each of these bills have all these moving parts, all these different programs I'm talking about. But eventually, once both, you know, legislatures vote on their bills, they're meant to be merged and then sent to both houses for passage. So it's intensely complicated.
Right. Okay. So just to recap, we have the, let me make sure I got this right. So September 2015, that was the original due date for the entire, like, finalized bill.
Yeah.
That has come and gone. The Senate, the Ag Committee, and then the Chamber drafted and finalized a bill that had strong bipartisan support.
It did.
In January. And now the House's committee has just released the first version of the bill, and it hasn't yet gone to the House floor for everybody's input.
Right. And disappointingly, there are some pretty significant differences between the House bill and the bipartisan Senate bill.
Which
came as a surprise to some and not to others.
Right, yeah, and that's something that we're definitely going to get into in a minute. But so any other kind of major players, you mentioned the, like, anti-hunger school nutrition association. Can you kind of give us a brief overview of you know, who some of these people are?
So if you watch the hearings, which being a school food wonk, I you'll see that how diverse the group is. So, you know, people who came to consult with the committees included representatives from state and agencies that administer these federal meals programs, you know, the people from the food industry, anti-hunger groups, for instance, No Kid Hungry and the Food Resource and Action Center, and many, many nutrition and public health advocacy groups. So I just mentioned, too, the Center for Science and the Public Interest is a big one. Another one we've been hearing from a lot is the Pew Safe and Healthful Kids Project, by way of example. And then also the School Nutrition Association, representing the school food service industry, those workers, and the military, interestingly, has been involved in this process.
Why has the military been involved?
Well, if you look back on the history of the National School Lunch Program, that was where it started. It was during World War II that the military discovered that the recruits were simply not fit to fight. They were malnourished, back in those days, malnourished meant they were too thin and weak, rather weak, and they're overweight.
Right.
So the military got involved with supporting Healthy Free Hunger Kids Act with the release of a report called Too Fat to Fight, which was signed by a great number of retired generals. And since that, they've established a group called Mission Readiness, which advocates for strong nutrition standards, and they're big champions of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you mentioned before there are major discrepancies between the two drafts of the bills, and I want to get into that in a second. But first, we're going to take a quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, and then we will dive into these differences and what they mean for the future of school food.
Just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food on Heritage Radio Network, about the House's proposal for CNR. Okay, so before we dig deeper, to kind of get into the discrepancies between the House and the Senate drafts, Laura, can you tell us if there are any major departures between the Senate bill, which we mentioned was finalized a few months ago, and the 2010 Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids Act? Which is the current iteration.
Well, I mean, what you can say is that not everybody got everything they wanted, but basically the bill is protective of the nutrition requirements that have really changed the face of school food, and also protective of measures taken to make sure that more kids who qualify for what we call free or reduced price meals — we talk a lot about free reduced rate in schools — more of those children got reached through policies, which I know you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So the bill was largely protective. You know, there was some disagreement over some tinkering with the nutrition regulations. But honestly, if I was a parent, it's nothing I'd lose sleep over.
So some of these, can you give examples of some of the healthier standards just to help us sort of explain what the House, you know, later on what the House wants to change?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act mandated certain servings at a certain level of fruits and vegetables for lunch, mm-hmm. which hadn't been before, and also mandated a change in grain and bread products, so more emphasis on whole grain. They have a new, they came up with a definition of what they wanted. They call it whole grain rich. It's very confusing for people not in school food, but basically what that means is that grain products offered at school need to be at least 50% whole grain in content, and the rest of it fortified, refined flour or wheat. So that meant no more white rice, it's all brown rice. Things like even things, traditional foods like tortillas needed to be reformulated so that they met the whole grain rich requirement. So it was controversial because it was kind of tough for mm-hmm. industry to adapt. But the good news is that they did, and so the whole grain rich standard has turned out to be successful, and yet there was still some, you know, what can I say? Like I said, tinkering around the edges all summer that went on.
Right.
But they came to an agreement that seems to be a good one. The requirement now allows for, you know, what we call a certain amount of kind of culturally sensitive foods to be served. So if you're in a for instance, in the South, you can some of the time now serve a white flour biscuit because it's a beloved traditional food. Or if you're serving students from a Southeast Asian background who are repelled by brown rice, you can, you know, on occasion bring in white rice to bring up your participation and you know, kind of warm them up to school meals.
So that's on the whole grain rich requirement,
right?
Which was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Any other sort of standout changes?
Well, so much was changed.
Yeah, you're like everything.
Major change with Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act is the real pillar of you know, like getting more healthy food to kids through the what we call the Community Eligibility Program, or CEP.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's really changed the face of the industry. It's like kind of revolutionary innovation for fighting hunger. Basically, the way it works is districts that have, or the way it is now, we'll talk in a minute about how the House is hoping mm-hmm. to alter it, but if a district has 60% or more children, quote, identified as eligible for free meals, and there's many ways that can be. So they can be kids who are in foster care or Head Start, they're homeless, migrant, living in households that receive SNAP, and so forth. There's all kinds of ways to identify these children.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's at least, did I say 60? I meant to say at least 40%.
Mm-hmm.
In that category, then the school can introduce what we call universal meal service, or free meals for everyone. And the reason that we say that we talk about identified students, that 40% are actually far from the only children that would typically qualify or, you know, be identified. So in an environment where you're able to identify 40% of your children as qualifying, the actual percent of kids who need that assistance is actually much more, another 20% or even more,
oh, wow.
more than that. So what's great about community eligibility is that it scoops up kids in the margins,
who
know,
might not
kids that
self-identify,
qualifying for some reason on paper,
yeah.
or that don't, you know, are kind of living in the margins. They don't quite qualify, but they're still struggling, and they're
right.
still from food insecure homes. So this just really changed things, and it really helped the, you know, the budgets of schools where they were serving these kinds of kids. Suddenly, they were getting federal reimbursements that really helped them do a better job.
And I think less sort of administrative burden to sort of sort out who is
yes.
Exactly.
And less administrative burden means you save money on labor. So
right.
it was huge.
Yeah. Okay, so that is the, and just to get put it into context, I don't know, to the best of, you can answer this, I mean, is 40% free and reduced rate, is that high, like, compared to all districts throughout the country, or is that, like, pretty normal? Like, what percentage would you estimate, kind of, are eligible
right.
for that provision?
Well, see, so that's where it gets a little fuzzy. So what I'm doing is really I look to the Food Resource and Action Center, and that they are really the authority in this. So when what I'm saying is basically I'm quoting them.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that when you're able to quote identify 40% of your children in your district or your school as needing this food assistance, in fact, there are many more that need it. So, and you know, so they've come to this. So, 40% might actually mean that there's 65% or more children that really need that food assistance.
Right, but nationally, like, do you know the percentage of kind of districts that are eligible for universal school?
Oh, that's a good question, and
yeah.
I can't answer it.
Oh, yeah. No, sorry about that. I know, it's just kind of confusing to think of, like, you know, I'm imagining our listeners, like, well, would this apply for me or, you know, to my district? I'm wondering, does FRAC have a resource where you can look that up?
Oh, yeah, all that's on FRAC. And I can tell you this, they estimate that 18,000 schools they know that about 18,000 schools are in the program,
mm-hmm.
and there's that's about 45% of the schools that are eligible, so there's more that could enter the program at the 40% rate.
Okay.
So right now the program is serving about 8.5 million children.
Okay.
And if the enrollment keeps going, that will go up significantly.
Wow. Okay. All right. So like a good chunk. There are a lot of people who rely on this.
Yeah.
This kind of programming. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about the discrepancies between so now that we know kind of the Senate bill, no major changes with the school nutrition programs that we've talked about that have been proposed, enter the House bill.
Yeah. Okay. Well, since we're talking about community eligibility, why don't we start there?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the House bill calls for moving that 40% to 60%. So given what I just said, that what that means is that, in reality, the only districts that have like a needs level of maybe, you know, in the high 80s or 90th percentile are going to be eligible. And FRAC estimates that I just said that 18,000 schools are currently in the program. FRAC estimates that about 7,000 would be dropped from the rolls.
Wow.
And of the eligible schools that haven't signed up yet, there's about 11,000 that wouldn't be able to enroll. So I think that's the biggest blow.
So almost the amount
of everything that's in this House bill.
Wow.
And then if we're looking at hurdles for insecure families, FRAC also points to a kind of dramatic increase in school meal application verification requirements. And so, you know, what this means is that, you know, it's just harder to apply if your family is homeless or migrant, if you are a new American family with limited English, you know, understanding how to apply, knowing how to time it is harder. So some of these people will fall through the cracks. We're going to lose kids who need this kind of, meal support. And then the other thing the bill calls for is a higher percentage of verifications from the school, from the schools, which means, you know, again, more labor hours. So, you know, whatever sample they were requiring before to determine what the free reduced rate was in a given district, they're asking for a bigger sample. And basically this is kind of like a hunt for fraud.
Is there a lot of fraud?
It's a lot more work.
Right.
And then
so it sounds like they're trying to kind of discourage
summer meals, which are also a hugely important when we're talking about food insecurity. As the Senate committee was, they are in favor of expanding summer feeding to include a new strategy for using EBT, so kids who can't get to a summer meal feeding site can still
user SNAP benefits.
Get access to assistance. However, it's more of a limited expansion in the case of the House. It's more of a pilot program, whereas in the case of the Senate's bill, it was a bigger jump in aid.
Okay.
The sort of good news is that the fruit and vegetable requirement went untouched. So that came as a good surprise. So,
right.
So the House, for now, the House committee is saying we will continue to require the same amount of fruits and vegetables on the plate. However, there's this stronger language around the review of nutrition standards to take place every 3 years. And it's really focused on revenue and participation impacts. So, I think they're looking for, more opportunities to say this is costing too much and more opportunities to interfere politically with science-based nutrition policy.
Okay. So, turning now. So you kind of got into the nutritional changes.
Sorry, I go all over.
Yeah,
the place.
No. We're good. We're great. So, all right. So we talked about the fruit and vegetable serving size stays the same. So why every 3 years if basically the purpose of reauthorizing this legislation, one of the purposes is to kind of review the science. The House bill is stepping in and saying, well, every 3 years we have to review the science and make sure.
Yeah, it seems meddlesome to me. And as I said, I think it's politicizing nutrition policy. And this is just me speculating, but that's how I read it.
Right. Well, so what does that mean? So they want to, they feel like their constituents are telling them that these changes are too hard, participation's going down. Like, why would they want to interfere?
Right. Well, okay. So the School Nutrition Association, representing a very broad constituency of districts, has been lobbying for some of these nutrition regs to be relaxed because it's for certain districts, especially districts that are serving kids who have money in their pockets, so districts that have a higher percentage of children who actually pay for their meals, they've been hurting as a result of these changes. Kids perceive the changed meals as not cool. Maybe they don't like them. Maybe they're not good in some cases. In some cases, they're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But kids will be kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those districts have been really vocal. I can't blame them, honestly. They need more support to adapt.
Right.
And SNA has really taken that up, which is, I think is necessary. I guess where I would fault SNA is that their kind of research on this isn't really research. So the surveys they take of members are not looking across at a cross section. If you look at their survey results about what their districts are saying about the struggles they're going through, they're not identifying which of them are high poverty and getting more federal reimbursement and actually having their participation go up versus those that have these kind of issues associated with retaining paying customers.
Right.
So it's
it gets very nuanced.
Yeah. So this every 3 years review, what the House is calling for is, well, you want to consult with people who are in the trenches and struggling to make these regulations work, and if they're losing money in it, or if their kids are not accepting it, we want to hear from them because we might need to adjust the regs then.
Sooner.
What could happen then is it undercuts any kind of incentive to work on the problem.
Right.
So, and anyone who listens to my show knows that we are all about working on the problem, and I've featured on my show many districts that have had to really work to bring their participation back up or even to stabilize it and have been successful at it. So it's not like it can't be done. It's just that they need support. So, I guess I feel like the House wants to just throw out the baby with the bathwater. And we have so many good examples of successful districts And what we need to be doing is helping more, you know, come on board.
So speaking of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, I want to talk about the fresh fruit and vegetable program.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's the right segue, but...
No, it's fine.
Just so throw it out there.
Yeah.
So what does the House bill say with regard to this really, really important, awesome program?
Yeah, so what's awesome about Fresh Fruits and Vegetable Program is that it's for high needs schools. So it's reaching children who aren't getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables at home. Fresh fruits and vegetables are very expensive, so we know that lower income families buy fewer of them. Many of these kids are living in areas that are what we call food deserts, so they're just not around. So Fresh Fruits and Vegetables Program is wonderful in that it gives them an extra serving of fresh fruits and vegetables and that experience in a really quiet setting. They have them in the classroom. So and you can make it, you can even like incorporate curriculum into it. So it's not like the crazed, loud, stressful environment of the cafeteria. It's in the classroom. It's fun. And it's a wonderful way, especially with young children, to get them to have their first taste of, you know, oranges and strawberries and snap peas and, you know, all that stuff. And that's what it does. The emphasis is on fresh, right?
Right.
And so what this bill does is it scrubs the word fresh. So now it's the fruit and vegetable program. And it allows for other forms of fruits and vegetables. So now you can bring in, you know, canned clean peaches or something that's been frozen and thawed out. And it's sort of like, why?
Well, totally.
The point of this program was that they'd be fresh. So it's cheaper, I guess, is why they're doing this. But it undermines the whole purpose of the program.
Oh, that to me is pretty devastating, or would be if it made it into the final version of the bill. Okay. Well, I'm a little discouraged. Where are we now in terms of like the time frame with all of this, with the process that you know, these two bills have to kind of have yet to go through?
I think we're stalemate. I think we're there with with the Supreme Court nomination. I think nothing's going to happen until the next election cycle, which is, there are some good things about that. It means that programs that are working now are on autopilot. Funding, for instance, community eligibility, those districts that haven't enrolled yet, they can go on enrolling. Because there's just not going to be any law that changes the policy. And the School Nutrition Association is really coming out strong and saying, let's enroll them. You know, let's get even a bigger critical mass to strengthen support for the program.
Right.
And the same thing goes for any kind of funding that's been authorized. What won't happen is any kind of change or increased funding where it's needed.
Until the fall, or maybe almost a year from now. Is that what it...
You think I know?
Yeah, I know. I know. That is a very, especially with this Congress, that is an impossible question to answer.
Right.
All right. So right now, likelihood, all signs point to an impasse. Great.
Yeah, it's an impasse. So, you know, we can just kind of go, you know, move with that assumption for the time being.
Right.
That's my understanding, anyway. I think it was you who told me that the House bill is not even going for markup until May. And like, do you believe that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, not if you know this was all supposed to be taken care of in September. I don't think that bodes well for the likelihood of this moving forward quickly. Okay, one final question for you, Laura. Is there anything, you know, for our listeners who are tuning in right now that you would like to tell them, you know, encourage them to do? That could maybe help move the needle or help encourage them to encourage Congress to reach a compromise and avoid this stalemate?
Well, you know, at this point, I'm sure there is going to be, you know, from FRAC and from some of these other advocates I mentioned, I'm sure there are going to be petitions and campaigns to contact your legislator with you know, what you should say, what you should write. Mm-hmm. This is all so soon that I'm not aware of any of those yet. So,
no campaigns, yes.
I mean, I can say contact your congressperson, right? And I'll say that. But I think that going forward, we're going to see some more organized efforts to lobby our legislatures. Or maybe not. You know, maybe we're all just going to wait for the election. I don't know.
Well, I think that it was, you know, it was to your point earlier, I think in your episode when you covered this on the show, you know, really hasn't gotten this bill in general hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And it was kind of released with, you know, to no one really responding. So I'm happy that we both had the opportunity to kind of cover it and raise these issues to make people aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to leave it there for a conversation on CNR today. But if you want more information and access to fabulous resources, be sure to check out Laura's website at InsideSchoolFood.com. Laura, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure, Jenna.
Thank you. Okay. Before we get going now, or before we wrap up, rather, I'm excited to introduce another segment for our listeners. If you have been listening regularly, you will know that last season we talked a lot about the exciting work happening in the food startup community, including the rise in the number and types of food startups, what the millennial-driven market is demanding from these companies, and even the types of programs available at places like the Food Business School, where you can learn the basics on how to launch your own food business. Building on the trend that we started last season, I will now be featuring an innovative and exciting new food organization or startup at the end of each episode. Joining me for today's maiden voyage of this segment is Kimi Zuki, founder of Good Bites Box. I really botched that. I'm sorry, Kimi. A mission-driven lunchbox delivery service that launched in March, right?
Yes. So we launched with the spring menu on March 21st, actually. We're like 5 weeks down into business now.
Awesome. So can you tell us a little bit more about the product and how it works?
Sure. So Good Bites is a seasonal, nutritionally balanced vegetarian meal based in Brooklyn. We deliver healthy lunches to offices and individuals working in Dumbo and the Navy Yard, with plans to expand to Williamsburg and downtown Brooklyn. So basically, we like to think of ourselves as a thoughtful lunchbox. We try to be as much conscious as we can in everything that we do, be it from sourcing to the packaging that we use. And our main mission, which is giving back to tech in schools, which we're going to talk more in details about in a minute, and the food waste. So today, food waste is a big part of the food industry, and we're trying to be as much conscious about this as we can.
Right. Okay. So so let's just to set the stage for the listeners. There are like food boxes, those compostable boxes.
Yes, exactly. So we have a seasonal menu that changes every season. Obviously, we have 10 lunch boxes on our menu. We feature one daily box every day from Monday to Friday. So those are 5 boxes, and then the next week we feature another 5 boxes Monday to Friday, and then we reloop for the season.
Okay.
But in our offering, we have two kind of offerings. We have the individual box, which gets catered to individual orders. So on any given day, if you feel like eating something healthy and giving back, so you can order by 11 a.m. and it gets delivered to your desk between 12 and 1. And then we have the group order. So we're trying to capture the catering and so for meetups and larger groups, in which we'd rather have 48 hours in advance notice, and you can choose any box on the menu and we'll deliver it to you.
And can you get the catering? Is it only during lunch hours? Or
yes. So basically, it's during lunch hours for now. However, we're still young and we just started, so we're trying as much as we can to accommodate other times if we can. So this is something that we discuss by email.
Right. Right. Okay. And so you mentioned you have a mission to give back to tech in schools. Can you tell us a little bit about?
So basically, Good Bites was born out of a mission, and today the mission is to try to bridge the tech divide in Brooklyn public schools. Brooklyn today is bustling with tech companies, and it's growing at a phenomenal pace. However, the state of tech in underserved public schools is still at an alarming stage. So access to technology in those schools is still disastrous. Teachers do not have the tools that they need for them to be able to give a proper education, let alone learn technology as in the coding world. So today the resources are missing from these schools. So what we do is we give back $1 from the sale of every lunchbox to Donors Choose. Donors Choose is a crowdfunding platform for public school teachers, in which a public school teacher can post a project in which they need, so whatever they need as a project, and people can crowdfund. So what we do as Good Bites, we take out $1 from the sale of every lunchbox, and by the end of the of every month, based on the sales that we have done, we bring those dollars together and we support different projects.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
How do you have a sense of how much, I mean, you're only 5 weeks old, so yeah, how much money you've raised so far?
So far we were able to support 7 different projects with and we have reached 353 students with those projects. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, so it's picking up really well. The mission is on point for tech offices, and this is our focus for now.
Your delivery, that's the delivery focus,
yes,
area,
so,
right now.
So basically Dumbo has mainly tech and design offices.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is the Brooklyn Tech Triangle that is trying to bring tech companies together between Dumbo, the Navy Yard, and downtown Brooklyn, and this is where you can find more than 1,400 different tech companies. So there is a market to capture, and there is a lot of giving back that can happen.
Right, on point with a company's mission, tech company's,
yes,
mission.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fabulous. So can you just tell us a little bit about your background and
yes,
how you decided to launch this business?
Yes, of course. So basically, I used to be in the account planning department of ad agencies, which is the strategy department. And what we do is try to develop products, campaigns for brands, but most of them are without purpose. So basically, what brought me to this is how can I channel my energy into something that has a positive impact on the community. And today, looking at technology as a sector in general, it is really defining our future. And if we do not support it from now, especially with kids and at a young age, I think that we can get to a place where we have a gap between in the market when it comes to people who have the background and mm-hmm. the knowledge to
who are prepared.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, okay, one final question for you. And I have to say, I love the branding. I think it is unbelievable.
Thank
it's
so
like
much.
One
Thank
of the so the cleanest, like most innovative brands that I have seen out there. And if this is even possible, the food is even better. So.
Yeah, but this is we try to make a point out of this. So basically, if a brand is conscious and is trying to help and is trying to be part of the culture of a community,
yeah,
it does not mean that it cannot be really well designed and well thought of. So the design aspect is something that we pride ourselves in,
yeah,
and we're very happy.
It's very strong. And the food, which I personally first came across at Brooklyn Food Works, because
yes, exactly,
you were providing a lot of the meals for free
for
everyone in the co-working space. It was unbelievable. And I was like, I need to track this down immediately and eat these every day. It was really, really delicious. So
cool.
Can you tell our listeners just... before we wrap up, where we can find your product?
Yes, so our product is online. You go to www.goodbitesbox. Bytes is with a Y in reference to the megabytes and the bytes in tech. So it's www.goodbitesbox.com.
All right. And with that, we're going to wrap up for today. I want to thank my guests, Laura Stanley and Kimmy Zuki, so much for coming on the show. And thank you to our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with help from the brilliant Austin Bernarski, who you all know and love. I also want to give a shout out to the newest member of the Eating Matters team, Taylor Lanzett, who we're thrilled to have on board. Show music is by the talented Tim Archer, and our engineer is Jack Inslee. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook, and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Lee Ute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.